digital marketer.
Today, we're talking GDPR compliance with Suzanne Dibble.
All right, Suzanne Dibble, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I was just saying, I'm a little bit sad it's our summer over here and we have a winter storm outside. So aside from that, I'm very happy. But the British weather is, giving my age away now, I'm 44 and I'm still depressed about the English weather. You would have thought I'd got over it by now.
Yeah, no, weather has a way of doing that. If it makes you feel better, I am currently sitting on the Atlantic Ocean on the beach in North Carolina, and it's about 85 degrees and sunny. So
that really doesn't make me feel happy.
Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really excited to talk about some of the fun things that are coming our way here in a couple of months. But I'd kind of like to turn back the time a little bit and look at how GDPR has affected us over this past year. I think the last time that we spoke was right before GDPR went into effect last year. And so I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, what has been the impact of GDPR since its inception last year?
Yes, it's a great question. And I recently did a webinar on GDPR 1 year on, because I think a lot of businesses have forgotten about it. Obviously, there was a lot of media around the time of GDPR coming into force. You couldn't really go on any business website without reading about it. So, of course, businesses of all sizes, and I work particularly with small online businesses of all sizes were paying it a lot of attention. But I think a lot of them seemed to think that it was a one-time thing where they got compliant and then could forget about it. And of course, that's really not the case. So what I'm trying to do is educate people as to why ongoing compliance is still so important. Because what we have seen recently is a lot of fines coming through the works because it takes a long time to investigate a breach of the GDPR. But certainly in the last few months, we've seen a lot of fines and a lot of high profile fines. Just a couple of weeks ago across Europe, we had, although it was headlined by the ICO in the UK, but it was a Europe-wide fine. British Airways data breach, they were fined 183 million euros, I think. So I'm not sure what that is on a dollar exchange rate, but a significant amount of money. And Marriott also 99 million. And we're seeing the headline fines. And of course, Google was fined 50 million euros by the French Data Protection Authority, and even more by the American authorities recently. 500 million, I think they were fined by your authorities. So we're seeing these very high profile, high value fines. But alongside those, we're also seeing fines for the smaller businesses. And I think that as those start to be more talked about, smaller businesses are realizing that it is actually still something that they need to take seriously. We've seen certainly a marked increase in data subjects exercising their rights. They're a lot more savvy now about their rights because of the press that was around GDPR. So lots more people exercising data subject access rights, where they basically write to you and say, how did you get my data? What data are you holding about me? Lots more people reporting breaches. You know, even you mean to CC people into an email, but you CC them instead, is technically a data breach. So people are becoming much more savvy about that kind of thing. And certainly all of the authorities, the data protection authorities around the EU, have seen a massive rise in complaints to the data protection authorities. There were 60,000 disclosed data breaches in the first 8 months after GDPR came into force. There were 94,000 complaints just in the UK. Ireland saw a 56% rise in complaints in the first year. And the ICO in the UK said that 2018 should really be considered a transition year. So I think that businesses who think that it's done and dusted are very much mistaken, and they really need to think about ongoing compliance. You know, my Facebook group is still going strong, which I'm very pleased about. Interestingly, a lot of people are still coming in and saying, this company's doing this, surely that's not allowed under GDPR. So lots of businesses still getting it wrong. And unfortunately, their reputation is being damaged in groups and communities like mine, where people are calling out that bad practice. Still lots of questions. You know, the guidance is still evolving, and we'll come on to talk about that later, I'm sure. So things are changing, not least the cookies, which we'll talk about in a bit. So still lots of complexity and lots of questions. So yeah, it's made a big impact on businesses. And I think the main message to get across is, you know, you've got to keep on top of your ongoing compliance, because it's not just a one-off thing that you did in May 2018 and put in the drawer, never to look at again.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that characterization of GDPR and just the fact that I feel like a lot of people have exactly done that, shelved it and said, I've done what I need to do. But my next question is in the direction of how is GDPR evolving? And as it evolves, how do you kind of stay up to date on what to do? What are the things that you need to do to make sure that you're compliant?
That is a great question, actually, because it's such a massive area. I mean, I spend pretty much all my time staying on top of this. This is my full-time job. So if you're trying to run a business, and we know what the pressures are on a sole trader or someone who's running a small business, you know, it's pretty much impossible to stay on top of everything that's going on. And that's the reason that I introduced my ongoing subscription package for £9 a month. People can basically have me do all the heavy lifting for them. Mm-hmm. And then I just update their documents when they need it or give them, for example, the recent revised guidance that both the ICO and the French Data Protection Authority put out recently on cookies, which is significant. I amended the cookie policy, put out a summary of the guidance because the actual guidance is, you know, tens and tens of pages long. But in summary, I mean, this is actually a very important point that we should raise here. So what people have previously been doing is relying on implied consent for cookies.
Right.
So you'd have a cookie policy that would say, by continuing to browse our website, you're accepting our cookies and you can go and turn them off in your browser if you want. But following the revised guidance, you have to have consent before the cookies are actually fired. And that needs to be an affirmative consent rather than just continuing to browse the website. Now, the problem is that there aren't really that many technological solutions that do that at the moment. And I'm working with someone actually to try and come up with that.
Okay.
But the two things that really came out of that revised guidance were no longer possible to rely on implied consent. You need an active cookie consent mechanism and that you need to obtain consent before the cookies fire. And that will have implications on things like Facebook ads. You know, if you can't have Facebook ads tracking someone when they land on a landing page or on your website homepage, for example, until they've actively consented to you doing that, you've got to tell them exactly what you're going to be doing with that data and how you're going to be retargeting them and all the rest of it, then you can't use Facebook cookies on that landing page or that homepage of your website unless you've implemented this cookie consent mechanism that enables you to get the consent before the cookies are fired. So things like that are significant updates. And I think we will soon see a fine against, I think somebody will be made an example of in the not too distant future. So best to get that all, certainly at least change cookie policy and keep an eye on the technological solutions that are coming out. But aside from that, in answer to will it evolve, you know, the regulations were so heavily negotiated over many years and they're such a beast of a regulation that I don't think they're likely to be amended or changed in the near future. But of course, what we are seeing is revised guidance, like I've just said about the cookie guidance, and in a number of other areas too. The ICO has just launched a consultation on data sharing, so we'll be seeing revised guidance on that coming through soon. And of course, we're also looking at cases. There's one just been decided in the last day or so, Fashion ID, all about Facebook like buttons. And the European Court of Justice has just said that if you use Facebook like buttons on your website, you're a joint controller with Facebook. You need to obtain explicit consent from the users and inform them about what that data is actually being used for. Because a lot of users, you know, they'll go and like your Facebook page from your website, but they don't really understand how that data is being used. And, you know, with all the trouble that Facebook's in at the moment over its privacy, it's not really a good thing to be a joint controller with Facebook. So Facebook are now looking at that in light of the judgment, and I think they'll be putting out some advice about that soon. We've also got the privacy regulations that are going to be in the next year or so. They're still being fiercely lobbied. I actually spoke at your San Diego conference about those new regulations, but they very much impact email marketing, well, any kind of online marketing, really. And they sit alongside GDPR, so that's going to be a big change coming soon. And SCA, really, which is, I suppose, the thrust of what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
It's not linked to GDPR except in the wider sense of security when making payments. It's all about making it more secure. So that there's that sort of link, but it doesn't really extend the scope of GDPR in any way.
Gotcha. Yeah, SCA, so strong customer authentication. I got that right, correct?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So SCA is something that I've been, you know, hearing a lot more about. And I've been doing a little bit of reading in terms of what strong customer authentication is all about. I would love to kind of hear from an expert like you, what does strong customer authentication mean for businesses who run commerce online within the EU?
Okay, so like you said, it stands for strong customer authentication, and it arises as part of the Second Payments Services Directive, which is called PSD2, a shorthand. And that actually applies to banks and other payment service providers. So it doesn't actually apply directly to us, the online business, but we suffer the consequences of this if we don't do certain things. So the aim of PSD2 is to establish safer and more innovative payment services across the EU. It's timely because it comes into force on the 14th of September 2019. If you're a consumer and you're buying stuff, you might have noticed that it's being used more often now, but the actual cutoff date is the 14th of September 2019 when you have to have everything in place, and banks are likely to start imposing it from then. But what it's about is enhancing security in electronic payments and online payments to reduce the risk of fraud. And actually, before I go any further, I should just say it's applicable to transactions in the EEA, which are European member states plus three other random places, Liechtenstein, Norway. Mm. I apologise to anyone who's from Liechtenstein, Norway or Iceland. You're not random places. Okay. It's applicable to transactions in the EEA where both the payer and the payee are within the EEA. And you might be thinking, well, what happens to the UK after Brexit? But it is likely to be continued in the UK, even though we won't be an EU member state after Brexit, if we actually Brexit. But that's another
right.
story.
Right.
So there are some exemptions, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But it's anticipated that about 95% of transactions will need to follow SCA. At the moment, some do. High-risk transactions go for strong customer authentication or the level of authentication that is equivalent, but it's going to affect the vast majority of transactions going forwards. And what it is, it's a process that validates the identity of the purchaser, and you need two out of three forms of identification. The first is something that the customer knows, for example, their password or their PIN. The second is something that the customer has, for example, a one-time code generated by a security token. And the third is something that the customer is, for example, their fingerprint or their voice. So if you are an online retailer, if you're taking payments online, this doesn't apply, by the way, to payments made over the phone. And it doesn't apply to payments made in the shop, for example, where you're using your card in the shop. But if you are an online retailer and you're taking payments online, then what you need to do is check that your payment processor is actually able to carry out this enhanced authentication, because otherwise the bank is likely to decline the payment. So I've looked at payment processors that I use to see how ready they are for this SCA coming into play. PayPal, it's likely that you're going to need to upgrade to PayPal Pro Hosted or PayPal Pro Direct, if you're not using them already, that is. But PayPal Pro Hosted, it's all set already. You don't really need to do anything. But PayPal Pro Direct, you have to integrate 3D authentication to your checkout. They partnered with a subsidiary of Visa, and it's a plug-in integration. But obviously, if you're not that savvy with integrations and that kind of thing, you're going to need your developers to help you with that. And it needs to be all sorted in time for the 14th of September 2019. So you need to get on the case with that. Stripe supports 3D Secure 2. Actually, they've got a really good guidance note. If you just Google Stripe and SCA, they've got a really good note on how they are going to try to rely on the exemptions as much as possible, because they see it as, you know, SCA is an extra step where you could risk drop off in people buying and see reductions in your conversions. So they are going to rely on exemptions for low risk payments to minimise the need for authentication. Infusionsoft have been extremely vague about it. I use Infusionsoft, and there's still, you know, I think lots of questions there that haven't been answered. So I'll be keeping a very close eye on that, because all of my transactions go through Infusionsoft. Yeah, I looked at Nexus Merchants because I have an integration there. And again, they've got a good guidance note on it, and they're making sure that they're going to be fully compliant with the SCA demands as well. So it's really important that now, you check on whichever payment processor you're using, Google them, and if there's nothing, if they haven't already done a blog post on it, email them and say, you know, what are you doing about SCA? Because if your payment processor doesn't have this available, the transaction will get rejected. And obviously that is not very good for business. So Stripe gave an example of what you'd need to do if you're an e-commerce store taking online payments. You'd need to get the new version of the Stripe checkout and install a new payments API. So if your processor is on top of it, there should be a very user-friendly article you can read and go and check what you need to do and get that sorted well in advance. So the exemptions are, and there's quite a few more, but I'm just going to hit on the main ones that are likely to be relevant. And you can't do anything about these exemptions. It's that your payment processor will either be savvy about them and try and build them into the process so that you have less drop-offs because of this extra authentication. Mm-hmm. But just so that you know, there are exemptions for transactions below 30 euros and also recurring transactions, which are the same amount, where you've already authenticated the first payment. Also, customers can whitelist you to show that you are a trusted beneficiary. And I'm not sure how payment processors are likely to implement that. But certainly for me, I have recurring transactions. A lot of mine is recurring transactions. Yep. And I'm sure that, I think in time, certainly Stripe seems on top of it. I'm sure they will build in some kind of process where people can whitelist me in advance. So I'll be keeping an eye on that. And I'll say there's a few more exemptions, but they're the main ones. The main takeaway is in what you have to do if you are taking online payments is check out that all of your online processes are up to speed with SCA and will have this in place for the 14th of September 2019.
Definitely. The best way that I saw it really explained in terms of a way that I finally was like, I get it, was Stripe. I actually read a whole guide that Stripe put out about SCA, and they were talking about essentially with modern mobile payment types, you look at Apple Pay or Google mm-hmm. Pay, they make you authenticate via your thumb fingerprint yeah. or via Face ID. Yeah. And that was that extra layer of authentication there. And so as you're going out and thinking about, you know, what does this extra layer of authentication mean? You know, the easiest way for me to understand that was like, oh, that simple step that, you know, I take to show my face or put my fingerprint on my phone is that extra layer.
Well, not necessarily. It's two out of the three forms that I mentioned. And that's one yeah. of them. And actually, okay. that's probably the one that won't be used as much because you need the fingerprint technology and the voice technology, which is more advanced than the other two forms. So it was something that the customer knows, for example, a password or a PIN, and something that the customer has, so a one-time code generated by a security token or some other method. So those are the two that I think will be most relied on. But yeah, I mean, okay. I'm all in favor of Apple Pay and, you know, quick fingerprint and you're done and it's very smooth. So, yeah, we'll have to see Definitely. What technology is employed by the various processors to make the consumer experience nice and smooth without this interrupting too many consumer journeys.
Yeah. So you did mention one thing that I wanted to get a little bit of clarification on. So is this affecting only online retailers in the EEA selling within the EEA, or is this all online retailers that have customers in the EEA?
No, so it's you look at it on a transaction by transaction basis, and it's only where the payer and the payee are in the EEA.
Okay.
So gotcha. Basically, if you are a company that is outside of the EEA, then it won't apply to you.
Okay. Do you foresee that changing in the future? You know, GDPR kind of came into play where anyone who had customers in the EU was forced to be compliant, mm-hmm. You know, among the GDPR rules for this. Do you foresee that becoming something similar to that we saw with GDPR?
It's always possible. I think that they probably would have tried to extend the scope now if they were going to.
Okay.
But I think that, you know, with all these things, other countries will follow suit to something similar. You know, the risk of, I forget the stats now, but you know, the risk online fraud is increasing year on year, and obviously this is all designed to cut down on online fraud. So yes, I think that other countries will follow suit. If it's not exactly the same, it will be similar.
Awesome. Well, I just want to kind of wrap all of this up and just, you know, from a general perspective, I'd love to hear your take on a little bit into the future. You know, these are some of the initial steps to really make sure that our online activity is secure and our privacy is secure, you know, but from your perspective, what do all of these changes mean for the future of online advertising and the future of online commerce?
Well, if you believe the lobbyists against the e-privacy regulations that's currently being debated in Parliament, that particular regulation spells the end of the advertising, particular types of the advertising industry. I don't believe that. I think that advertising has to evolve. You know, this has all come about, GDPR particularly has come about, and the new e-privacy regulations, because people are doing things under the radar and not being upfront about it. And that's what the EU Parliament doesn't like. People do not understand that they are being tracked around the internet and the level of the surveillance that goes on. And they're not even saying don't do it. They're just saying you can't hide the fact that you're doing this anymore. And, you know, as a consumer myself, you know, I think that's a good thing. It's got to be a good thing, hasn't it? I think the industry, particularly the advertising industry, that's up in arms about the new e-privacy regulations and saying it's going to, you know, take 30% off their annual profits. Well, you need to adapt and evolve. And we're already seeing very successful examples of advertising agencies that have done just that. So it's interesting, isn't it, though? You know, you see all the bad press about Facebook and privacy. They're slammed with these big fines. We know about these apps that are just data mining through Facebook and other sources. And yet nothing is damaging Facebook's market cap at all. You know, it's still going from strength to strength in terms of its profitability and people using it. We know what Facebook's doing with our data, and yet we still use the platform. So
yeah,
it's really interesting. There's more big data where data's being linked up to get a really composite view of data subjects so that you can target them even more. The Internet of Things, you know, there's been loads of stories about Alexa listening into your private conversations and Siri listening into your private conversations. And yet people will still buy. I bought a new Alexa show the other day, Echo show the other day, and you know, I know I've read all the stuff about, you know, some really private conversations that were disclosed to other people by mistake through Alexa and Siri and things like that. But you still do it. So I don't know is the answer. I think that, I think if anyone's interested in this area, read the keynote by Apple's CEO. And he talks about this is a really critical moment in our future, actually, because in 20 years, everything, you know, machines will be talking to machines. We know that. Everything will be, you know, the smart home is the tip of the iceberg now. You know, 20, 30 years, it'll all be joined up. And this is a critical moment in whether we do have regard for our privacy and whether organisations respect that or not. And the Apple CEO's talk makes a quite concerning reading. So if anyone's interested, Google that. It gives an insight into where we are with privacy and technology.
Yeah. I listened to that, and it is very interesting to kind of hear, you know, about, you know, a company like Apple talking about what this means for the future. But I agree. I think that's a great resource as well. Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for sharing with us your knowledge and your insight into all of these things that for most of us are fairly complicated and quite frankly, a little bit scary. But it's good to get this clarity and just a little bit more information about what this means for us in the marketing world and the e-commerce world. But I know that you have resources available. I know that you have tons of additional information that you can share with people. So where can people find out more about you and what you've got going on in terms of staying up to date on all of these regulations?
Yeah, my Facebook group is probably the best place to go, actually. It's called GDPR for Online Entrepreneurs. We've got about 35,000 people in there from all around the world. And I share my free resources in there and do regular trainings and Facebook Lives and things like that. And then if people want to go for the paid subscription and get the documents and the updates and the guidance and all that, they can do. But there's tons of free stuff in there anyway. So,
yeah. Awesome.
Oh, actually, can I say one more thing, actually?
Of course,
If you want to join the Facebook group, please answer the questions, because we won't let you in if you don't answer the questions.
That's a good tip.
I've got to be quite strict on it because I can't be seen to be offering advice, you know, because of regulatory reasons. So I have to get people to say, I understand that you're not giving me any advice. And
So
if people don't answer the questions, we just don't let them in. So we've got over like thousands of people who've applied to join, and we haven't let them in because they haven't answered the questions. So please answer the questions if you want to get let in.
Yes. All right. You've heard it here first. Answer the questions. I know that struggle. I know the same thing because we have the same policy. So, well, again, thank you so much, Suzanne. Maybe this time next year, we'll do another update. Hopefully, we'll see you back at Traffic and Conversion Summit in 2020. Again, have a great day. And I hope everyone listening got a little bit out of this and can go and join the group and get a little bit more. So thank you so much, Suzanne.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Digital Marketer Podcast. For more information, go to digitalmarketer.com/podcast. Thank you for listening.
Hey, DM listeners, if you're running a Black Friday or Cyber Monday special, listen up, because Digital Marketer just released our Canva Holiday Promo Pack. It includes almost 200 templates that you can use to make the graphics for all your upcoming holiday specials and 3 unique design themes for each holiday. The Promo Pack is usually $27, but you can get it today for free. Check the show notes for the link to download, or you can go directly to digitalmarketer.com/LP/holiday templates. That's digitalmarketer.com/LP/holiday templates.